This podcast of NPR's On Point with Tom Ashbrook is a production of WBUR Boston.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. According to the latest poll, 55% of Americans now think going to war in Iraq was a mistake. More oppose the war, and even more disapprove of President Bush's handling of the war. Tory Clark says it doesn't have to be this way. Clark was chief Pentagon spokesperson during the Afghanistan and Iraq invasions. She sold the war in Iraq. Now she says President Bush should sell it again, with honesty and openness and fireside chats. But what about the misinformation at the heart of the original push to war? Tory Clark's new book is titled Lipstick on a Pig. She's got answers. We've got questions. Up next on Point, the woman who sold the war. We'll hear later in this hour from Michael Massing, author of Now They Tell Us, The American Press and Iraq, and from Tom Bowman, Pentagon correspondent for the Baltimore Sun. But first, joining me now from Washington is Tory Clark, chief spokesperson for the Pentagon from 2001 to June 2003. She was press secretary for President George H.W. Bush's 1992 reelection campaign and press secretary for 6.5 years to Senator John McCain. She's currently a senior advisor to Comcast and a CNN analyst. Tory Clark, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
Also with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly magazine. Jack, good to have you.
Hello, Tom. Hello, Ms. Clark.
Hello.
Tory Clark, I say a little bit in fun here, but not exactly. The book feels like a kind of victory lap. Is that a fair way to describe it?
I don't think so. I really don't think so. And I'll tell you quite simply, I wrote the book because I go out there and give a lot of speeches, talk to a lot of different people, and some people for whom I have enormous respect, people I've worked with or people I've known for a long time and are in the business, said you really ought to put some of this down because they're important principles. They're very common sense principles. There's really nothing new about them. But because I've had some pretty amazing experiences, both in the public and private sector, I've got some great stories to tell. So it was really just trying to be useful more than anything else. And you know, I never really added up the number of pages in each chapter, but I think the chapters in which I'm talking about the mistakes I've made, and there have been plenty of them, is probably the greatest bulk of the book. So I don't know too many people would call that a victory lap.
We'll look at that, and we want to hear your stories. I mean, it is you were right there in the front row. You described being in the Pentagon down in the sort of communications center, control center on the day that the plane hit, the way the building shook, Don Rumsfeld walking in covered in sweat and dirt and stinking like the smoke and fire outside. You've got this amazing moment later where you're in bed with your husband on the night that the invasion of Iraq is to kick off. And he has no idea. You know very well. You can't tell him. You're clicking around channels with the remote control looking for the news that has begun. He grabs it and says, "What are you doing? Stop that." Was it? Give us a sense of your road to this position, Tory Clark. Where did you come from to end up as chief spokesperson at the Pentagon?
Well, it was largely because I failed at several things. I grew up wanting to ride horses and ride them professionally, and that didn't work out. And I ended up in Washington, D.C. in 1979, and I wanted to be a photographer. And I had a deal with the Washington Star, a wonderful newspaper, which is no longer, in which I would do everything, including sweep the floors and wash the windows and answer the phones, and they'd let me go out and take pictures occasionally. And Time, Inc. ended that career. And that's how I first met then-Vice President George Bush. I was a photographer helping out his photographer, and that turned into a job in his press office. And that's how I started first really interacting with the news media and getting on the communications side of the business. And then I'm just one of those people who stuck around for a long time, never planned to, and have just worked for some terrific people, from the older Bush to John McCain and Carla Hills and several others in between.
You're an imposing presence, 6 feet tall, shock of blonde hair, cut kind of punk style for a long time. The clips
I'm glad I'm on radio.
You were known as torrential for the way you'd let it rip. As I recall, in 92, you said Pat Buchanan would have to grovel on glass before you'd support him speaking to the Republican convention then.
On his knees with his tongue hanging out, if you want the complete quote.
With his tongue hanging out.
Yeah, one of my not-so-fine moments.
I guess I wonder how you look at what has transpired since the war was sold. We want to look at how that happened. We'll talk with some journalists as well about that. But, I mean, just I was sitting here thinking before we began the news at the top of the hour, you know, death squads in Baghdad, the UN all over the U.S. now on Guantanamo, these new pictures out of Abu Ghraib,
You know, just in the last week, we've got the top CIA guy, Paul Pillar, I'm not sure how you pronounce it, saying he's writing now, if the entire body of official intelligence on Iraq had a policy implication, it was to avoid war, or if war was going to be launched, to prepare for a messy aftermath. Lots of casualties in Iraq since this war was launched. You were there for the invasion, the kind of toppling. In retrospect, as big an operation as that was, it looks simple compared to the aftermath. How do you look back on the ramp to war here? Are you glad you succeeded in selling this war?
Well, I'll tell you, I think the people who were involved, the people in uniform who were involved in the first several months of the war would hardly say it was simple. I think in the first few months alone, 141 young people lost their lives. I don't think they or their families thought it was simple.
And I'm not demeaning a moment, but I am contrasting it with this long,
sure,
costly aftermath when we've taken most of our casualties. I hope you see what I mean there.
Sure. Well, I think the way you started the question was, you know, how do you feel when you look at it now and how things have transpired?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And there's a fair amount of frustration. And the frustration is, I agree completely with any newspaper, any news organization that highlights and puts an emphasis on the bad things that are happening, whether it's Iraq or Afghanistan. They should. They absolutely should. My frustration is that's not a complete picture. It's not necessarily inaccurate, but it's not a complete picture. And, you know, I have the luxury, and because I'm just a news junkie, I read several newspapers a day, I look at several websites, I watch a lot of news on television. And so I know if you dig through those papers on A32 or on Saturday mornings on one of the cable networks, you'll see some programs about, say, the historic elections in Iraq, or you'll see stories about the number of schools reopening.
I don't think those were on page 32. The elections got quite a lot of coverage
got a fair amount of coverage,
yeah.
But there's still important work going on in Iraq in terms of the road to a more representative form of government, a more stable representative form of government, and we don't hear that much about it.
But you've got
understand. No, wait, let me finish.
Yeah, sure.
I completely understand why the news organizations make those decisions. I just wish everyone had what I had, which is a more complete picture of what's going on. And I honestly believe it is all about long-term public support for what the administration is trying to do there, what the government is trying to do there. To have long-term public support, the public needs complete understanding, and I don't think they have complete understanding, and it's not really their fault.
But is the public really ignorant? We've got people right there in Washington, Nebraska, Senator Chuck Hagel saying not long ago, you know, when he thinks about Iraq, he says, how we went into it, no planning, no preparation, Republican senators' words, no sense of consequences of where we were going, how we were going to get out, not enough, no exit strategy. This is a pretty well-informed Republican senator. I mean, does it give you any pause when you look at the problems, the rather formidable problems that are there now, about the presumptions that were there as you were selling it going in? I guess you're saying no.
Well, actually, let me come back to that. But sure, you have Chuck Hagel saying what he's saying. You have very smart, very well-informed senators like Democratic Senator Joe Lieberman, who is one of the absolute pillars of intelligence and decency and responsibility
saying we've
in the
got
United
to hang
States
in there.
Senate, saying he thinks it was the right decision, knowing everything we know now, knowing the huge intel mistakes that were made on WMD, knowing the problems we have, still thinks it was the right decision, as do I. Were there terrible, horrible intel mistakes? Absolutely, shared by every civilized country around the world. Were there things we didn't know going into it? Absolutely. But I know some people who acknowledge that, saying there are certain things we know, there are certain things we don't know. And, you know, anybody in uniform will always tell you that you can have the best military plan possible. Things are going to change when you get on the battlefield. And they did. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'll tell you my personal feelings about what I expected and what turned out so differently.
Mm-hmm.
There were places in Iraq where the Iraqi people were very, very happy and were very glad to see the coalition come in. There were places where they weren't. I was struck, I continue to be struck, by how psychologically brutalized the Iraqi people were by that regime. I knew it was terrible. I knew it was awful. I was struck by how brutalized they were psychologically and how hard it has been for them to really take control of their own country. Now, they're making progress. They're making terrific progress. But I think it's a huge hurdle for them. The resilience, if you will, of the insurgency, it's a surprise to me. But if you really step back and realize the kind of world in which we find ourselves, it's not that surprising. Mm. It's difficult. It's very, very difficult. But again, we're making progress there. There's a great story in the Washington Post today about a unit that's over in Iraq that has returned to Iraq after being there in 2002 and 2003. And when they face different circumstances on the battlefield, and I'm using that pretty loosely, they adapted. They changed their tactics, and they're doing better this time. That's what you do.
And yet, there's the critique, and it's a huge one. Jack Beatty, here's Tori Clark, present at the creation, right there at Don Rumsfeld's elbow. And now she's writing Lipstick on a Pig. What do you hear in the broad outlines of this story?
Well, you know, I'm looking at a book, and if you look in the index, I was shocked that I didn't see the name Jessica Lynch there. We all know that story, and here's the quote from the Washington Post in the story that, you know, made her out to be fighting for the death and so on. She was fighting to the death, one official said. She did not want to be taken alive. We don't know who that official was. Later on, Jessica Lynch herself said, "They use me to symbolize all this stuff. It's wrong." Now, one of those statements is spin, and the other one is truth. One of those statements is propaganda, and the other one is a moral stand-up. It's wrong.
Tori Clark, what do you say?
The Jessica Lynch story is a wonderful example of people needing to have all the information. If you go back to when that happened, and for people listening, Jessica Lynch was taken captive, and
she was presented as fighting to the last minute.
She was presented by the Washington Post, a story by Vernon Loeb, who is a wonderful young reporter. It was Vernon Loeb and another reporter. And their initial story, which was very, very dramatic, was, and their sources were attributed as intel sources. Now, you need to know that when that happened and when she was rescued, we at the Pentagon were doing everything possible to say nothing at all until we got to ground truth on the ground. What had happened? What was her physical and mental situation, which was our greatest concern? Having worked for John McCain, I know a little something about POWs and the impact on the families. We were doing everything possible to say nothing at all until we had real information.
That is, at
the
podium
Post,
at the Pentagon.
Correct.
But somebody out there in the field was...
Wait, let me finish.
You know?
The Washington Post writes this incredibly dramatic story.
Sourced.
And it was sourced to intel sources. Mm-hmm. Every reporter in the building comes in the Pentagon, comes running in and says, "Oh, my God, we need to do this. My bosses are chasing after me." We did everything we could from the podium and in private conversations with reporters. And they were largely Pentagon reporters to say, "Don't go there. We're doing our best to get the real information, but don't go there." I went so far as to tell several reporters, "You need to know off the record that I have talked to a doctor who has seen her medical records, and this is not jiving with what the Washington Post had." And then you can, you know, believe or not believe me, but this was such an issue, and it was so it had become so hot within the media here in this town that Knight Ridder, the news organization, did an investigation into the Jessica Lynch story. And one of their conclusions was the Pentagon went out of its way to downplay the Jessica Lynch story. So you don't have to take my word for it, but Knight Ridder had an entirely different take on the entire situation, and if Jack's going to quote things, it'd be nice if he quoted from the Knight Ridder report.
The Pentagon, at the end of the day, but it's a long way there, and we've grown accustomed to the Pat Tillman story. After Your Watch, a tough one,
the way that came out,
and his parents have just lambasted the military for the way they described it, how dishonestly that was conveyed. But what about the core issue here? On WMD,
sure.
You were on the front lines of this. Jack quoted Don Rumsfeld. Of course, there were many others. We've got just a parade of people coming out since the war and saying the intel was massaged here. It was cherry-picked. Most recently, Paul Pillar. Did you end up feeling bushwhacked on this? Were you fed bad information? Were you fed it by your boss?
Well, everyone had the bad information. My boss had it. The president had it. The French, the Germans, the Russians. Everyone had the same intel, which says that they have these weapons of mass destruction and they clearly have intent and desire to use them.
But all the reports that we're looking at here are about that intel being massaged and cherry-picked.
Look at the
CIA guy. He's the most senior CIA guy who's come forward since the war, and he says, you know, all the implications of this were to avoid war, not to go in. He says they were ignoring and distorting pre-war evidence.
Well, if you continue to pull that thread and say, okay, then U.S. officials massage the intel, then these same U.S. officials ought to get credit for the greatest multinational effort ever, because they convinced the French and the Russians and the Germans and the U.N. to massage it, quote unquote, not my word, yours, the same way.
Credit or squandered credibility there?
Wait, you go back.
Even our Secretary of State was before the United Nations, and it turns out that whole big speech was what? Bunkum.
Sure, but let me finish a sentence again.
Yeah.
an absolute knock to the credibility of this country, an absolute knock to our intel capabilities, and to everyone else's. Everybody can have his own opinion about this. They do. People can change their opinions. They absolutely should have the right to do that. But if you go back and look at the debate about going into Iraq in the fall of 2002 and the first part of 2003, it wasn't over whether or not he had the weapons of mass destruction. It was over what to do about it. If you go to the preamble in the many, many UN resolutions saying Iraq has to cough it up here or there are going to be serious consequences, in the preamble itself, it says, among other things, knowing the dangers the Iraqi weapons of mass destruction pose to the region and the world, we, the UN, therefore resolve, and then went on to what the serious things they resolved to do.
And that's the debate as we heard it, but now we've got these voices saying that wasn't the real debate going on behind closed doors. I want to bring another voice in here, if I may,
sure.
Tori. Michael Massing joins us from New York. He's a media critic, contributing editor at the Columbia Journalism Review. He's author of Now They Tell Us, The American Press and Iraq. Michael Massing, thanks a lot for being with us.
Glad to be here.
You spent a lot of time looking at this. You've had brickbats for the American press and the way they reported the ramp up to the war. Now we're hearing Tori Clark's side of the story. How do you look at the roles that the Pentagon PR in the person of Tori Clark here this morning and the press played in this road to war, Michael?
Well, in the book you mentioned, the articles I've written, I certainly go, I'm very critical of the press. I think they did a terrible job in terms of largely just going along with the administration and not exercising the necessary skepticism and independent-mindedness needed. But, you know, the Pentagon itself, Jack Beatty anticipated something I was, you know, I also looked at Ms. Clark's book, and in many ways it's a nice book. It's got a self-deprecating tone, but again, I looked up weapons of mass destruction. There's one paragraph there. I mean, Paul Wolfowitz, Douglas Feith, people who were central in sort of massaging the intelligence aren't mentioned, nor is Ahmed Chalabi, who of course had direct access to the Pentagon and was providing defectors who were then used by the special units within the Pentagon to provide information. I mean, the information we've gotten from these defectors that was relayed by the New York Times and other places has turned out to be completely false. And curveball, one of them who was interviewed by German intelligence, I mean, I think it was the Washington Post, did a story about just the mishandling of the intelligence on that, and nobody bothered to sort of check what the guy was saying because it was so convenient to the administration. I just could go on, and it's disappointing in a book that's about lipstick on the pig. I mean, we have an 800-pound pig sitting here, which is one of the most disastrous foreign policy decisions, I think, in American history. I think it's going to go down that way. And I just find a lot of lipstick being put on it here. If we go to Abu Ghraib, I mean, there's another episode. Ms. Clark, who continues to just be very complimentary toward her former boss, she says, lost in most of the coverage of the Abu Ghraib scandal was something remarkable, something that transcends communications principles or tactics, and it relates to basic decency, excuse me, and honor. It will take years to appreciate, but Rumsfeld's testimony before the Senate Armed Services Committee on May 7, 2004, should be studied and admired as a true act of responsibility, accountability, and courage.
When he said, this is not our way, words to that effect.
He said that...
No, he said, I'm responsible.
And said he would prevent further abuses. I mean, there's been basically a complete failure to pursue the torture scandals and how far up the chain of command they've gone. And I don't know. Statements like that just seem like a lot of lipstick to me.
Tori Clark, what about it? On the one hand, we've got a lot of journalists saying Tori Clark is a straight shooter. She works hard to do her job. You've got blurbs on the book from Marvin Kalb and others, you know, pointing straight to it. You say, I'm all about no spin. And yet, they're, in retrospect, I hear what you're saying, but you see how much spin Americans are perceiving was around this war. I guess I come back to wondering if you feel hoodwinked in retrospect or like you had the whole story.
Oh, I feel terribly about the intel. Absolutely. Absolutely, positively feel terribly about the intel. And people who are far smarter and more knowledgeable than I am should write books about that. People who are far smarter and more knowledgeable than I am should write books about the WMD issue. Absolutely. You know, this is not a book about national security. It's a book about communications. But again, yeah. There's a common thread here. And people should give, I'm happy for people to lob as much criticism as they want. but they should give the complete picture. To the extent I discussed Abu Ghraib in the book, because that all transpired, it blew up after I had left, I talked about all the terrible things and the failures in the system from the top to the bottom. But I also said, accurately and I think importantly, many, many times people in leadership positions, whether it's public office or the private sector, get slammed because they don't take responsibility. So you may hate Don Rumsfeld, you may love Don Rumsfeld, but this is a case where he went up before the Senate Armed Services Committee and took responsibility.
But has the U.S. military in toto taken adequate responsibility for what's happened there? As a communicator, what's your sense? I mean, it's still roaring. These new pictures out today, I've seen them.
Well, new old pictures, to be absolutely accurate.
But again, new, new to, we're the country, you know, new to us, and they're horrible.
And, absolutely.
And yet the kind of chain of responsibility for this, Don Rumsfeld talked about it, took it rhetorically, but it hasn't gone very high in terms of real consequences.
Oh, my God. There are more investigations and more censures and courts martials than you can count on four or five hands.
All very low-level people have been charged in this. It's gone.
Well, I can tell you, some of the people who have been charged and been convicted don't consider themselves low-level. But again, to the extent I addressed in the book, and remember, I tried to be careful about talking about those things I had familiarity with, and that really did all explode after I left. Mm-hmm. But I said this was awful. From top to bottom, it was awful. No two ways about it.
Guantanamo was on your watch. The UN in the last couple of days saying this is essentially torture. You've got to get those guys out of there. You've got hundreds in there, and a handful have been charged with anything. You say that was misunderstood because we saw the pictures of guys on their knees in the jumpsuits, ears covered with earmuffs and faces and the rest. Has the UN got it wrong now, or was it wrong then? How do you see it?
Well, I haven't been there in a long time, and I am not, I don't get information on a daily basis. I am fairly confident that the overwhelming majority of the detainees there get treated quite well.
Way back when I was there,
and we went down a couple times, and one time we took a few senators, including Dianne Feinstein, down there. Dianne Feinstein, who used to be the Bureau of Prisons for the state of California, was quite impressed and said so.
And when you read about them strapped in their chairs and force-fed to protest their continued detention, do you think maybe they should be out of there or force-feed them, pump the juice?
In very, very unconventional times, as we are in right now, you've got to do something with the detainees. I can promise you it's not a task anybody wants. Nobody wants to be the keeper of these people for a long time.
But most aren't charged with anything. So
Let me finish a sentence.
Please, yeah.
There are lots of different circumstances down there. What's important from my perspective is putting as much transparency against it. I argued for and failed, saying, why don't we have people in there all the time? Why don't we have cameras in there 24/7? Mm-hmm. Why don't we let everybody see what is going on here? Because when they see the complete picture, they'll say, wow, these people are being treated quite well, and I have far fewer concerns than I've had before.
Or on the other
hand, somewhat ironically, one of the reasons many of those suggestions were rejected way back when was when you are trying to treat people in accordance with the Geneva Conventions, you don't do anything that would uphold them. This is ironic, I believe it. I understand. You don't do anything that will put them in a situation that could be considered public ridicule or humiliation.
Boy,
I disagree. Yeah. I think if you had cameras everywhere, if you let reporters come through there once or twice a week, you wouldn't have as many concerns.
And you're right, if only Abu Ghraib had embedded reporters, there might have been a preventive inoculation there from what happened, but it did happen. We've got a lot of listeners who want to join us. Let's turn to them. Mark is calling from Acton, Massachusetts. Hi, Mark, you're on the air.
Good morning. How are you?
We're well, thanks.
I have to say that I believe I've been hearing a considerable amount of spin from you, Ms. Clark, this morning as to the intelligence failure. Was the intelligence bad? Perhaps it was. But this war is not the result primarily of an intelligence failure. It's a result of one of the most colossal judgment failures in American history. You say the French and the Russians believed that there were weapons of mass destruction, but what you do not say is that the French and Russians and the Germans felt that the prudent course of action was to have verification, to have inspections. We had inspectors on the ground who were pleading for a few more weeks. The biggest misrepresentation of all was contained in President Bush's signing statement when he said, quote, if we go into battle as a last resort, end quote. He didn't intend it to be a last resort, and he did not act as if it were a last resort. They shot first, they asked questions later. And frankly, that's why Vice President Cheney's unfortunate accident has been such a powerful metaphor for this administration's policy.
Mark, let us put it to Ms. Clark.
Well, he raises a very important point. It is different than what we were talking about before. Looking back now, knowing what the information is, would the decisions have been different? Perhaps. But again, I go back and you can look up all the public debate. You can look up what the UN said. The debate wasn't about whether or not he had the weapons of mass destruction.
But the debate's been
really
updated
wasn't.
A lot. We've learned a lot more about it, haven't we?
Sure, but that's what I'm saying. Hindsight is 2020.
Well,
it's very easy to say now.
But you know,
my God.
At that time, if I may jump in here, Michael Massing.
Yes, please.
The International Atomic Energy Agency under Mohammed al-Baradei, which was after the inspectors went in late November, by the time of Colin Powell's speech, they had already filed two reports, which basically said, we have taken radioisotopes, we have interviewed officials, we have seized the hard drives of procurement computers, we have done this and that. They found no indication whatsoever of a nuclear program there. And that really was the issue, whether they had a nuclear program, much more important than the chemical or biological. And there was a massive failure in this country, and I blame the press a lot for not reporting it. I certainly blame the administration for ignoring and diminishing at every turn the inspections process, which, as the caller said very astutely, the French, the German, the Russians, all felt it was working. There was so much evidence. If our press had done a better job reporting that, look, our country was so determined to go to war and was so united behind the president, and the Pentagon was part of the whole machine pushing that, and we see where it's taken us.
Michael, I've just got you for another half minute here. Then how do you see Tori Clark? She presents herself, and she's got journalists saying yes as the champion of transparency here.
Well, I think Ms. Clark, did her job very well. She was very effective in putting forth a policy that has turned out to just, I feel, is disastrous. I wish she showed more thoughtfulness and candor, I guess, in sort of coming to grips with the consequences. Look at our image in the world if we're talking about communications. It's after 9/11, everybody was behind us.
Michael Massing, thanks a lot for being with us.
Glad to be here.
We're also joined right now from Alexandria, Virginia, by Tom Bowman, Pentagon's correspondent for the Baltimore Sun. Tom, thanks very much for being with us.
Good to be with you.
You were there in the briefing room when Don Rumsfeld was at it, when Tori Clark was at his side or herself at the podium. Looking back, do you feel, did you get transparency? Did you get hoodwinked? How do you look back on this era?
Well, I guess there are two issues. It's the run-up to the war, and did they have the intelligence is one issue. And the other issue is the war itself, how it was conducted. Were there enough troops there? There were problems with supply lines along the way. And, I thought Tori did a pretty good job. She was always approachable and responsive generally when we had needed information. Secretary Rumsfeld is another case, I would say. You can press him on certain issues. You can press him up against the wall, and then he'll lash back and oftentimes not answer your question, then go on to somebody else.
And all that, did it leave the American people knowing what they needed to know?
Probably not. He's very good at avoiding answering questions.
Tori Clark, you're loyal to your guy here in Don Rumsfeld. He was out front more, you write, than the previous three defense secretaries combined very quickly after 9/11. How about Don Rumsfeld as a purveyor of transparency?
Oh, I think absolutely. More accessible, more outreach than, as I said, any of his predecessors, two or three of them, put together. And people who cover him on a regular basis often say to me, you may not like what he says, but he's giving it to you straight.
Was he giving us the supply line problem straight, the dearth of troops, we didn't have enough on the ground? Were we hearing that straight?
If any of the listeners have the time or the energy, they can go to the Pentagon's website, defenselink.mil, and get all the transcripts of every briefing and most interviews, complete transcripts, not just what appeared in an interview in a newspaper, what appeared on the television the evening, but the complete transcript of the complete interview or the complete briefing. And you will see a lot of comments and statements and responses to questions from Secretary Rumsfeld saying there are lots of things we don't know and we'll have to change and adapt and scale as we go along. And there, you know, he would obviously emphasize some of the positive things would happen, and he would also say there's a lot of tough fighting left to go. We will have problems. There will be peaks. There will be valleys. Now, I have no problems with people pointing out the negatives. I just wish, and in fairness to their readers and to their listeners, they present the whole picture.
Jack Beatty, the whole picture, how are you seeing it here?
If you click on Google under Rumsfeld's lies, there are 335,000 entries.
Now, and we know everything on the Internet is highly accurate.
I'm not such a fool as to say that. But this is a heavy burden for Mr. Rumsfeld. And if you start looking at that material, there are interviews on Meet the Press, on other forum, where he says something, and it appears from contemporaneous records that he knew otherwise. There are statements about, I gave you the one, about we know where they are. We know where they are. They're northeast, western, south someplace. That was about the weapons of mass destruction. And we know on the other side, what did happen, you know, we know Paul Wolfowitz isn't in your index. Paul Wolfowitz, who appeared before the Senate Armed Services Committee and said, this war is going to pay for itself. The Iraqi oil will pay for the war, no problem. According to Nobel Prize-winning economist Joseph Stiglitz, it may cost, when you factor in the medical and psychiatric bills, it may cost as much as $2 trillion. We have the example of people who told the truth, General Shinseki. We need 100,000, maybe 200,000 more troops to make this work. He was cashiered. We have the example of Mr. Lindsay, the White House economic advisor. He said the war might cost upwards of $50 billion to $100 billion. Of course, we now know it's $400 billion and growing. He was cashiered. So you just can't say that this war was conducted transparently. You can't say it against what Lawrence Wilkinson, who was Mr. Powell's chief of staff, has said. He said the war was run by a cabal from Doug Fife, Mr. Rumsfeld, Mr. Cheney, back and forth, and that Mr. Bush seemed to be. Sometimes decisions were made even without Mr. Bush being involved. You can't just blink all that away.
Tom Bowman?
If I could quickly add, I mean, that's true, but what Shinseki said, several hundred thousand troops would be needed for the post-war effort. But also, when I was over in Iraq, I got a one-star general, Oscar Hillman. He was a National Guard general from Washington State. He asked repeatedly for more troops to secure the area he was at. He was at Balad Air Base, and he said on three occasions he asked for more troops and was told he couldn't get any more troops. So there were generals that I spoke with over there and others who knew they couldn't ask for more troops because they knew they wouldn't get them.
But the president was saying, and I believe Secretary Rumsfeld, Tory Clark, that we'll give the generals what they say they need, what they want. Jack's making a pretty large attack here on the transparency of this, saying, you know, at bottom it wasn't transparent, though you may have fought for transparency in many facets along the way. How crystalline this view?
Well, Jack covered a lot of things, and you know, I'm sitting here jotting them down trying to decide which ones to address. But let's just address the Shinseki one for a minute, because it has become urban legend that he said, and Tom Bowman has it correctly, he said several hundred thousand, that Shinseki was cashiered for that. It was well known, and it was publicly known, I think it was a couple of months or 3 or 4 months before he said that he was not going to be re-upped.
Are you saying in fact he was on his way out and there's no cashiering about
it? People are saying Shinseki said this outrageous thing that was we were going to need several hundred thousand troops and then he was fired. Not true.
No,
it was well known months
Tory,
before that he was not going to re-up.
Tom Bowman?
I could quickly jump in. You know, Tory's absolutely correct that he was scheduled to leave several months later, I think in May of that year, after his time as chief of staff of the Army. He was not cashiered. That's absolutely right.
Of course, there's something between like cashiering and just voluntarily retiring.
I mean, No. This
term,
is a very
no,
important point.
His term was up. He was going to retire anyway. Mm-hmm. His time was up. But I would like to ask Tory, why didn't Secretary Rumsfeld or Paul Wolfowitz show up at his retirement?
Not invited.
Why not?
Ask General Shinseki.
Let's take a call. Leslie's calling from Alexandria, Virginia. Leslie, you're on the air.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I'm calling to sort of support Tory Clark. I mean, there's a lot of talk about transparency, but what we've forgotten is that we had very little transparency prior to the war on a lot of things that we now know much more about. before the war, we didn't know that the UN was engaged in a massive oil for food scandal. We did not know that the French were undermining us behind our back, or at least the public did not know that. We now hear ABC News playing tapes from the mid-90s, where we hear the Saddam Hussein talking about using WMD against our cities or having someone else do it in his place. I mean, when it comes to transparency, it's not as if this was clear-cut and in an atmosphere with no clarity. What do you err? Do you err on the side of caution, or do you err on the side of just allowing these inspection teams to run willy-nilly around Iraq when we know very well that Saddam had a very sophisticated system for eluding them? How long does that go on?
You're saying the transparency here, that the problem with it was on the other side of the ledger.
No knowledge. We had no clear knowledge. Had we not?
No knowledge, but you've got Paul Pillar saying the weight of what we knew before the war said, don't go to war, avoid war.
No, I disagree with that. I watched it very closely from my vantage point here, and I'm a person who watches a lot of foreign policy
issues. This guy was head of the CIA, National Intelligence Officer for Near East and South Asia. That's not a bad seat.
Well, exactly, but I'm saying that there was a mixed bag of information, and I also read Ken Pollack's book, and he's a national security expert who took a position that said, this guy's dangerous and he is in fact going to re-up his weapons program at some point. At what point do we decide we're going to deal with him? And if you think the UN was going to do anything, I absolutely think that was a fantasy.
Leslie, we hear it. Tom Bowman, please. Yeah.
Yes, I think when all is said and done, when the historians sit down in the coming decades and write about this, I think they'll find that Tony Zinni had it right. Tony Zinni was Tommy Franks' predecessor at Central Command. And Tony Zinni said repeatedly, he's a Marine general,
yep,
that Saddam Hussein was in a box, keep him in a box. And that's the way to keep him. He didn't have to invade. He had access to all the intelligence as well. And that was his opinion. And I think it was the right one.
Tory, now we look at the polls. The latest CNN USA Today Gallup, 55% of Americans saying it was a mistake to go to war in Iraq, 42% saying it was not a mistake. What do you make of public opinion on this now? Is the public slowly, winkling out the truth here, slowly coming to the correct view, or are they slowly drifting off of the view you would recommend?
Well, I don't agree with it, obviously. But as I said, people can have their own opinions, and they can feel the way they want to feel. I just wish they all had a complete picture. It doesn't mean you're going to have 85% approval ratings, and I cringe when I hear people use that word in association with war, but you're not going to have stratospheric approval ratings, but I think you'd have greater understanding and greater appreciation and greater support if they had a more complete picture.
And you think the war is being that misrepresented, the situation in Iraq? I mean, we talk with people in Iraq and they say, my God, it's become a kind of tribal no man's land teetering on civil war.
It's become that incomplete. You could pick 500 people off the streets in the United States and say, okay, do you know how the Iraqi people feel about the United States being in Iraq? And they'd say, oh, they hate it. They hate us. We're the enemy, that sort of thing. But if you really pay attention to poll after poll after poll after poll, what is consistent from the Iraqi people is they're glad Saddam Hussein is gone and that we did it. They don't like us having us there because nobody likes to have people in your country helping them run it. But they don't want us to leave any sooner than absolutely necessary because they want to get the job done. People don't hear that third piece very much,
and
I think they should.
They've got a problem now, that's for sure. And most Americans say hang in now. But looking back, a lot of questions about the decision to go in the first place. Camille's calling from Charleston, South Carolina. Hi, Camille, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks. I'm a communications major,
mm-hmm.
and I'm curious how your guest defines and where she draws the line between communication and manipulation.
Straightforward question. Tory Clark?
Sure. Obviously, I think manipulation is trying to make something appear better or different than it really is. It probably shouldn't have that cynical connotation, but it certainly does. Communication, I tend to think, informing, educating, making people aware.
So when you were helping sell the war and you felt the urgency of doing that, we read it in the book, did you feel like you were informing or manipulating? How did you draw the line in your own mind?
Trying very hard to give people as much news, as much information about what was going on. That was one of the main purposes behind the embedding project, was to give people as much information as possible about what was going on, the good stuff, the bad stuff, the in-between, and there was plenty of all of the above, so they could make an informed and educated decision for themselves.
Tom Bowman, Tory was a big champion of embedding reporters with the troops in Iraq. On balance, in retrospect, what's your sense of how that worked out in terms of conveying accurately, fully, what was going on there?
I think it was a very, very good idea. It gave the American people a sense of what their troops are doing. It gave a lot of reporters with no experience with the military a sense of who the soldiers are and the Marines and how they work. Overall, it was a great idea. But you can't just have reporters with the troops. You have to have reporters, as we had in Baghdad, and also operating independently of the troops to get a total picture of how the war was progressing. But I would like to say that, and that one of the big reasons for the embedding process wasn't because everyone at the Pentagon slapped their foreheads and said, well, that First Amendment's a great thing. Mm. One of the big reasons, if not the paramount reason, was they were afraid of Saddam Hussein lying about some problems in the country. Let's say an orphanage is bombed, or Saddam does something to his own people and then blames it on U.S. troops. They wanted independent observers on the front line so they could counter any misinformation from Saddam.
And that's absolutely right.
There was Tory's idea from the get-go. Of course, it also put journalists inside that circle. Sam's calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Sam. You're on the air.
Okay. Just two quick sleight of hands, I believe, Ms. Clark is performing. One, just with Shikenzi or whatever, the issue isn't whether he was cashiered or not. The issue is what he said, and maybe he didn't invite Rumsfeld because of the way his advice was taken. Who cares about whether he was cashiered? But my main point is she kept on referring to public sources. I think when history is written, it will not be what the public sources were. The most important issue is what did Bush and the people who made the war plans know or think about in their inner chambers. And what we hear from people who came out was that they were determined to carry on the war willy-nilly, anything they said in public. So who cares about public sources? The issue is what information were they acting on, and when did they make a decision regardless of what was going on outside?
Sam, thanks very much for that. Tory Clark, how about it? Jack points out, and it's true, Paul Wolfowitz, Douglas Feith, Chalabi, they're not in the book. Did you have the sense of, you know, the sort of war being cooked up behind the screen, the goal being handed out to you, and off you go, now Tory, sell this?
Well, again, the book is about communications. It's not about national security. Clearly, those stories run through sections of the book.
How do you separate those two? I mean, you describe your work as central.
There are some of those stories running through the book. Mm-hmm. But I got to tell you, one of the reasons you don't see a Wolfowitz, a Chalabi, a Doug Feith, as Tom Bowman knows, I'm not going to sit here and defend Doug Feith for anything, but they were not big players from what I saw.
Is that because you were not in the innermost circle?
No, I respectfully push back on you on that one. But I'm somewhat amused, if not discouraged, by the urban legend that has become of this cabal of the so-called neocons. I never saw them having that much influence on this process. I just never saw it.
Final thought.
The only way I know what Chalabi looks like is because I've seen his picture in the paper. I never saw him in the building. I'm not saying he wasn't there, but I never saw him in the building. I did not see any communication between him and the secretary, for instance. I'm not saying it didn't happen because I didn't see every single piece of paper. I didn't see, every phone call. But I just never saw or felt the presence of those influences that people describe with such nefarious terms.
You quote Abraham Lincoln in the front of the book, public sentiment is everything. With public sentiment, nothing can fail. Without it, nothing can succeed. By that measure, how's Iraq going?
Roughly. I've said that in the beginning, and I'll say it at the end. Very, very roughly. And for some very good reasons. These are difficult, difficult issues. There is nothing fun or easy about any conflict. There just isn't. And this one is particularly difficult. I think the public support would be greater if they had a more comprehensive picture of what was going on.
Tory Clark, former spokesperson for the Pentagon from 2001 to 2003. Her new book is Lipstick on a Pig. Tory Clark, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Tom Bowman, Pentagon correspondent for the Baltimore Sun. Tom, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Jack, we just got 20 seconds. What do you think?
Well, I mean, I think she did a good job there by her lights, but the question is, beyond her lights, was this war honestly sold? And that's going to be one that the historians are going to look over for a long, long time.
A long time. We're looking right now. Jack, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.